BizNews Power Hour.
Welcome to the BizNews Power Hour. I'm Michael Apple. It's Thursday, the 10th of March. Well, this is the penultimate episode of your Power Hour. Friday will be the BPH Digest edition with no local news or markets, just a compilation of the most downloaded interviews of the week. The BizNews Power Hour will no longer be broadcast from next week. All of our standalone interviews can be found on the BizNews Radio channel on Spotify, so do go check that out. To tonight's show, editor Alec Hogg speaks to Francois Norquier, a man behind the development of the Port of Gauteng. He believes that rail infrastructure, if Transnet gets its house in order, is the way to go. And his development hopes to create a terminal that will be the most efficient, cost-effective in Southern Africa. Then our London correspondent, Linda van Tilburg, speaks to Jeremy Borain. He's one of South Africa's leading publishers from Jonathan Ball Publishers, JBP. Borain will be taking up a post at Icon Books, one of JBP's newly acquired British companies, in April. Then you'll hear my voice as I chat to advocate Aaron Richards about the role of financial institutions in state capture. There are a lot of questions being asked about how billions could have been spirited out of South Africa over a period of years, with banks only starting to close accounts in mid-2016. To see the full interview with Aaron Richards, go to BizNews' TV channel on YouTube. Let's get to your news and market report now, for the last time, with Nadia Swart.
BrightRock believes that with every change in life comes opportunity, and the markets aren't any different. The daily movement in the markets means change for us all, sometimes small, sometimes big. This daily market report is made just for you by BrightRock, the first ever needs-matched life insurance that changes as your life changes.
South Africa is the most unequal country in the world, with race playing a determining factor in a society where 10% of the population owns more than 80% of the wealth. This is according to a World Bank report on Wednesday. South Africa is the most unequal country in the world, ranking first among 164 countries, the Washington-based institution said in a report called Inequality in Southern Africa. Nearly 30 years after the end of apartheid, race remains a key driver of high inequality in South Africa due to its impact on education and the labor market, it said. When race is considered as a factor in income disparities, the report added, its contribution to income inequality amounts to 41%, while contribution of education is reduced to 30%. The government is considering extending the national state of disaster despite the cabinet's promise that it would end on March 15th because it has yet to finalize alternative legislation to manage COVID-19. The government declared a state of disaster in mid-March 2020 in response to the pandemic, using its sweeping powers to impose regulations controlling the movement of people, the size of gatherings, mask wearing in public, curfews, and periodic bans on the sale of alcohol and tobacco. The issue of lifting the state of disaster has been high on the government's agenda this week and was discussed at a National Coronavirus Command Council meeting on Tuesday and by the Cabinet on Wednesday. The council was set up after the start of the outbreak and has attracted controversy as critics question its legal and constitutional standing. The Cabinet is due to hold a post-meeting briefing on Thursday. President Cyril Ramaphosa will face the first motion of no confidence in his leadership on March the 30th. This will be the same day his Cabinet's fitness for office will also be called into question. National Assembly Speaker Nosiviwe Mapisa Nkakulu announced on Thursday morning that both motions would be held then. Mapisa Nkakulu added that voting on both motions would be done openly and there would be no secret ballot. She rejected a DA request that members of the executive not participate in the process because of a possible conflict of interest. In the financial news, Nedbank CEO Mike Brown has added his voice to calls by senior business leaders for less talk and more action on the structural reforms needed to kickstart economic growth. Echoing the sentiments of FirstRand CEO Alan Pullinger, who last week bemoaned the glacial pace of reform efforts, Brown said SA needed to act yesterday to cut red tape dramatically to boost investment, particularly in power and energy. Brown said red tape was undermining President Cyril Ramaphosa's surprise decision in 2021 to lift the threshold for embedded power generation to 100 megawatts. Oil fluctuated after the biggest drop since November as the fallout from Russia's invasion of Ukraine continues to rattle markets. Futures in New York swung between gains and losses after plunging 12% on Wednesday to just below $109 a barrel. Oil sank after the United Arab Emirates called on OPEC Plus to boost production faster, though the nation's energy minister appeared to temper that message a few hours later. The slump came just days after prices closed at the highest level since 2008 on Monday. The JSE All Share Index was higher at 73,664. In the currency markets, the rand is slightly stronger against the major currencies at 15 rand 10 cents to the dollar, 19 rand 90 to the pound, and 16 rand 74 to the euro. Gold is trading at $2,006. A Kruger rand will put you back around $2,011. Brent crude is trading at around $116 a barrel. The JALTEC cryptocurrency basket is down 6% for the day. And Bitcoin, the premier cryptocurrency, is trading at around 592,000 rand.
This daily market report was made just for you by BrightRock, the first ever needs-matched life insurance that changes as your life changes.
Today is Thursday, March 10th, and this is your FT News Briefing. Equity markets rallied yesterday on hopes that European leaders will take action to ease the economic impact of the Ukraine war, and Citigroup's struggling to offload its Russian retail bank. Plus, we'll check in with our Paris bureau chief on how the war in Ukraine is affecting French voters as they get ready to head to the polls next month for a presidential election.
Ukraine is clearly figures large now because it's such a serious crisis, you know, a war in Europe on the borders of the European Union. But like all elections, a lot of it will be decided on the way the economy was handled and so on.
I'm Mark Filippino, and here's the news you need to start your day. U.S. and European stocks staged a big comeback yesterday. The S&P 500 was up more than 2.5%. The NASDAQ ended the day more than 3.5% higher. This came as energy prices eased. The price of Brent crude was down around 11.5%. Investors were betting that European leaders will take some action to limit the economic impact of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The European Central Bank meets today, and other EU leaders are gathering in Versailles to discuss an integrated response. Here's the FT's Brussels bureau chief, Sam Fleming.
There's clearly some discussion now about whether there needs to be more common borrowing, common debt issuance to fund the collective response to this crisis, including the energy side of things. But there is a lot of member states would argue there's actually a lot of common debt being issued already in the EU. It's too soon to be talking about adding to that common debt issuance. And so the focus really needs to be on maximizing the use of existing facilities rather than trying to conjure up new recovery funds or whatever at this stage. I think this debate isn't going to go away. Clearly, there is going to be an ongoing push from especially some southern parts of Europe for extra EU budgetary muscle to be put behind the fight against the current economic crisis. But this is something that's always tended to divide the EU. So I think it's probably a little early to expect any deal on this now.
Sam Fleming is the FT's Brussels bureau chief. Citigroup is trying to get rid of its retail bank in Russia, not because of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. It's been trying to offload the consumer bank since last year. But now Russia's at war and its banking industry has been slammed by sanctions. And because of this, our U.S. banking correspondent Imani Moiz says Citigroup is having an even harder time getting rid of the business.
Well, the only publicly confirmed potential bidder is now sanctioned. So you can't do a transaction with that bank unless you get a specific waiver from the government, which it looks like the government's going to be pretty unlikely to grant, given just the direction it looks like geopolitical tensions are going right now.
And as you report, Imani, Citibank Russia is not small. It's got about 500,000 customers, deposits have been growing, and it's profitable. What is Citi going to do if they can't sell it?
Well, they can petition for a grant from the government, like I said, or they can find a non-sanctioned buyer. However, just from the conversations that we're having, it seems like there aren't a lot of people who are interested in touching Russian assets right now. That's looking unlikely. And then also just getting rid of the business, winding it down, closing up shop, which of course would be an expensive process because you have loans out to consumers and you want to be paid back. If you're shutting down, what motivation do you have for making good on that promise?
That's our U.S. banking correspondent, Imani Moiz. The war in Ukraine is overshadowing the French presidential election. French voters head to the polls next month, and at the moment, the incumbent, President Emmanuel Macron, is leading the race among several candidates. To talk about where things stand and how the war in Ukraine is weighing on French voters and candidates, I'm joined by Victor Mallet. He's our Paris bureau chief. Hey, Victor.
Hello.
So, Victor, real quick, can you give us a little bit of background? What's happening with these elections?
This is Emmanuel Macron, who's standing for re-election after 5 years in power. He kind of swept the board at the last election in 2017. He was a surprise candidate. He said he was neither right nor left. And he basically sort of demolished the traditional candidates of right and left in French politics. And he's now standing for re-election. It looks as though, from current polling, as though he's going to win again, although, of course, nothing is certain in French or indeed any other politics.
So, Victor, Macron was going to have a big event this weekend, but then he postponed it because he was going to be too busy with diplomatic efforts to get Putin to try and stop the war in Ukraine. Has Ukraine and Macron's involvement been good or bad for him and as a candidate and in the polls?
Yeah, no, he's always been very internationalist. He's always been very active on the diplomatic front. I mean, that is, in a way, the job of a French president. They tend not to get too much involved in domestic politics, and they tend to do stuff on the international stage. And he's actually tried, since he took office in 2017, to try and bring Vladimir Putin on board, so to speak. You know, he says Russia must be recognized as a great power, as a European power. He's done that all the way through his presidency, and sometimes to the dismay of some of his European neighbors, and indeed to the Americans, I think. But he's always said, look, we have to talk to Putin because it's the only way we're going to avoid war. And of course, that accelerated in the build-up to the invasion of Ukraine, and ultimately he failed. But the signs are that voters do not hold it against him.
So how much of this election is about Ukraine, and what are the other big issues on the minds of voters?
Ukraine is clearly sort of figures large now because it's such a serious crisis. You know, a war in Europe on the borders of the European Union is a very big deal. But like all elections, a lot of it will be decided on the state of the economy and the way that the pandemic was handled, the way the economy was handled and so on. So a lot of domestic issues are coming up as well. But it is true that the crisis in Ukraine has kind of overshadowed a lot of the issues that other candidates, Macron's rivals, were trying to raise in this election campaign. For example, Eric Zemmour and Marine Le Pen, the two candidates from the far right, they were very much talking about law and order, about Muslim immigration to France and how terrible these things were. And that has actually been pretty much buried in recent sort of debating because of the crisis is so severe and because the economic factors, including the ones that are sort of exacerbated by that war, the high cost of petrol and diesel, for example, the high cost of fuel for heating homes has really affected the way people think about the issues that matter.
So there are a number of candidates, a few that you just mentioned, Victor. Can you give us a rundown of Macron's key rivals?
It looks from the polls as though his most likely rival in the second round is going to be, once again, Marine Le Pen of the far-right Rassemblement National Party. She was his rival in 2017. He beat her then. He is forecast to beat her now, although it's not certain. And he's forecast to beat her by a narrower margin than he beat her last time at the moment. But the war in Ukraine has actually done some damage to the other candidates, including initially Marine Le Pen, because she and the other far-right candidate, Eric Zemmour, and the far-left candidate, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who are all quite high in the polls, were all basically sympathetic to Putin. And indeed, they've had to kind of rapidly backtrack in most cases to sort of explain how they're not really Putin lovers after all.
Victor Mallet is the FT's Paris bureau chief. Thanks, Victor.
Thank you.
Before we go, Amazon announced a 20-to-1 stock split yesterday. The move is meant to boost the stock price in the face of heavy operating costs and concerns over staff retention. Amazon's last stock split was in 1999. In another effort to boost its stock price, Amazon also announced yesterday a $10 billion share buyback. Investors seem to like all this. Amazon shares jumped more than 10% in after-hours trading.
François Nocquier, you are rapidly becoming our go-to guy when it comes to anything to do with the rail network in South Africa. Not surprisingly, you've got a big vested interest here in it. You're the developer of Port of Gauteng.
That's correct. And we can do a magnificent rail park. And so if rail can work, we can also do much better than what we'll do if rail doesn't work. So yeah, we would hope rail can be what it should be in South Africa.
Now, I've seen Port of Gauteng on the way to Durban. It's just outside of the Vosloorus area. Why is it positioned there?
It's the entry point, exit point of Gauteng. So if you go out, it's the tunnel where all the roads get together and then it goes on to the N3. And if you come in, it's what we call the champagne position. The N3 is the stem, and then the cup is where all the people live up to Lubumbashi. And this is just before it splits, because there's not much between Durban and Joburg. It's the host pipe between the tank and the garden. And we're just there where the garden starts.
And just down the road from you is Tambo Springs. Now, you've been tackling them.
I haven't been tackling Tambo Springs. I've been tackling the Gauteng Department of Roads, Gautrans, for activities that they've done there, which we don't think complied with law. And we got an interdict stopping them from building the off-ramp to Tambo Springs.
It's a heck of a job. How long did that court action take?
It took 2 years and 6 months since we wrote them the first letter. We wrote to them the 1st of August in 2019. We got the interdict on the 4th of February 2022, cost 2 million rand, and 30 months later.
And you did that because?
I did that because they messed up the EIA. A lot of things were left out. They never dealt with the petrol pipe. Petrol pipe, the environmental consultants didn't even know the petrol pipe existed. There's a wetland next to the N3 there. It got declared a synthetic wetland when it's not a synthetic wetland. The connection road in Tambo Springs was in the middle of a sensitive floodplain. They stated in their own EIA, when they amended the EIA, because 7 out of the 8 properties was left out of the EIA, so how that happened, I don't know.
So why would they be so stupid as to do that? It sounds like a really dumb approach. Where you got all these things that were wrong with it, which the courts have now agreed with you on.
It's a good question. You know, we look at it and, as I said, there's 15 properties which you need to get an EIA on. 8 of them was originally left out. 7 was put in. They left the 15th one out. There's a wastewater treatment plant at that Total filling station. The new road was going to build right over it. That wasn't disclosed to Total. It wasn't disclosed to the tenant of the petrol filling stations. They didn't know about the petrol pipe. They know.
How big was this development going to be?
It's 1,500 hectares, the whole Total Tambo Springs, if you take all three landowners together. It's a massive thing. It's a 50 billion rand development that they planned.
And they didn't do the basics right. Why? Didn't. Why? Is it because they thought they could find another way to get the approvals through?
I wish I knew. Or arrogance, we government, we big, just do it. We don't need to tick the boxes. It's for the general public, private developers that must tick the boxes. Nobody caring, not the EIA was done by Gautrans. Maybe those officials isn't as caring as a private developer, but it was a whole spectrum of jokes. Not giving proper notice, not having proper public participation, not knowing who the owners are. When they amended, they had to amend it again. They left properties out.
I admire what you did, because we have these rules in South Africa, these laws, but not too often are they applied. And in this case, you said, you've got a commercial interest in this, so that's fine. We know you've got a vested interest, but at least you applied the law. But I actually wanted to find out from you about the wonderful statements that we're hearing from our president. In the State of the Nation address, we've got this third-party rail network that's starting. In other words, third parties can get onto South Africa's rail network. They can start using it. That we desperately need, especially right now when the commodity boom is on, to try and get better efficiencies going through. You've been looking at this in a lot of detail, and I'd like to know from you whether our President Ramaphosa is going to be able to deliver on these promises.
I don't think it's up to them. It's still a big question, how much money you're going to have to invest, and then is it really going to work? You know, you put money in building a terminal, you put buying the trains, and then Transnet falls off the wagon, and you're still running it on Transnet's railway lines. The guys that's looking at it are nervous. It's big decisions to be made. It's a lot of money to be invested, and they've seen this, and they speak to us about it. And Durban Harbour is also going to have some private sort of form of privatization or joint venture, stuff like that. So the big boys are looking at it. But
what are they nervous about?
Is it really going to work? You know, is it we spend all this money, because it's never been. What is the regulator going to be like? You know, what if we got a dispute? It's hasn't been done. It hasn't been tested. You know, it's like it's new territory, and then like anything else, new. In especially, you know, is there going to be a clawback? Is the government going to want too much? Is the government going to have an open hand and allow more freedom? Let the private enterprise price run it totally from A to B. I think they'd be much happier if that line gets privatized and some private guys buy it, and they're out of government hands, and private guys can run Durban Harbour. But they're nervous about the sort of 50-50 approach. And is it going to become 70-30 or 30-70? And, you know, it's never been done. So they're cautious in it, but at least the blood is flowing there. There's inquiries there in Port of Gauteng. On Friday, we had a plane flying up and down along the railway line and on the provincial road and on the farms around. So somebody are looking and somebody is surveying and seeing, and there's agents that are now interested. Before, it was quite quiet under COVID, but you can see a page has been turned and there's some blood flowing. So it's a relief.
So the idea here is, if you get the railway lines working again, then from your perspective, that is, you're perfectly positioned for that to be a hub.
Yeah, a terminal. We can put a very efficient terminal there where you can load off stuff very quickly and very cheaply. So we think we will become the number one container hub in Southern Africa if it works. Then you don't need to put everything on road. The minerals and whatever can come to that area, be stuffed in the container, go down with the container. The container can be loaded off there. We've got 2.2 kilometers of flat land, straight. Because you've got such a blank canvas, you can design something that works very productive. And two of the other three boundaries are provincial roads. And the national road is just down the road. And the petrol pipe is there, the data pipe is there, the gas pipe from Secunda to Alberton is just up the road. So there's a lot of possibilities.
How many trains are actually running along that rail
line? Very
little
at the moment.
What's about very little?
Two a day in one direction and two a day in the other direction.
And what were they at the peak?
Those are container trains, because there's no more jet fuel train. There used to come a jet fuel train every day. It's obviously not demanded ORT for. And then there used to be two car trains in each direction. The car trains still come. That's the video I took for you in Howick, in Nottingham Road. Mm. But it now detours to Central Rand and then hook up with a diesel locomotive. Because past us, somewhere between Germiston and Kalfontein, the wires have been stolen. So now the car train's shortest route is past us. It's now going quite a loop to the Far East Rand to get to Kalfontein, because the wires haven't been replaced since COVID.
I remember when Portia Derby, the CEO, was doing a presentation, I think, to the mining in Derby. She said that there was about 5 kilometres of cables that were being stolen a day at that point. And is this what you're talking about, that the cables have gone and, it must be very difficult to replace them, but secondly, what does it do to the ability for these third-party people who are coming onto the railways to use efficient trains?
I don't know why they couldn't fix that link, because next to us, they also steal the cables. Once they stole it twice in 1 week, just as they replace it, they stole it. They got the eyes now. There's eyes on the line. So if the line gets stolen or cut, then the train driver at least can see this, like cat eyes at night. And it still gets stolen there by us, but then it gets fixed the same day or the same night and the trains go again. Why the car trains don't come part of Port of Gauteng to Kalfontein, which is the shortest route, I don't know. After the lockdown, when I saw the cars didn't come anymore, I one day drove to Kalfontein, and they told me now it's taking the detour and I slept back. And boom. And it seems it's still going that route. So before lockdown, we used to get six trains, in this time of the year, six container trains that went up to 10 container trains in October in each direction. Now it's two, so it's a third of what it used to be. And the N3 is fuller, so it's not that we import or export less, it's just Transnet has lost two-thirds of the market share of containers before COVID, between start of COVID and now. In 2 years, they've lost two-thirds of it. So they must also, they used to make a loss on that line in any case, because they had to subsidize it from 2014 onwards, when they angered the truck guys or scared the truck guys, and the truck guys started competing. Now it must be a financial disaster for them.
For the taxpayer, really. Yeah, because the taxpayer's got to put it in there.
Yeah, because it made a loss, and now it's running at a third of its capacity. The car train must now go on a loop to go about it. There's every now and then a steel train from Newcastle that used to come to Mittal Steel's yard there near O.R. Tambo Airport. And then there was the odd and so on, whatever, and then there used to be a jet fuel train every morning coming. So at the moment, it's just the two container trains a day in each direction on average.
So when the third parties start using the rail, presumably they would need the electricity as well, or are they going to be running it on diesel? Because they aren't, from what you're saying, the cables, the electric cables.
No, but they fix it, and when they say, you know what a cost it is.
But that must be horrific, the cost.
It's horrific. That's why somebody, it's what I said to you, I don't think Porsche or Derby and the staff has got the ability to stand up against organized crime. And I think if it's too big an organization. Maybe the small oak also can't. If I say small oak, the smaller guy. Transnet has got 55,000 employees. The Natcor line might employ 1,000 people if you privatize that. And if you've got a company with 1,000 employees and it belongs to, say, a Bidvest of this world or an Imperial or somebody like that, without, you know, not that they are looking, but I mean a private enterprise. You had a Brian Joffe type guy, Mark Lamberti type guy on top of it. I'm sure they could have done something about the security and be more focused and stuff like that. Because we need it. Durban can't be Durban one day and bring all those things into Joburg with just by road. You know, Bayhead Road is clogged, and it needs to come out by rail. So if we're not going to bring it out by rail, where are we going to bring this stuff from? Because you can't take it to Quebera or to Cape Town.
What you've said, Francois, is certainly, it makes a lot of sense, and surely everybody knows it, especially the people at Transnet. Haven't they put something on the table, and the government as well, put something on the table that can work or will work, or are you dubious that this third party's use of the rail is actually
going to be the operator. So the guys we are talking to, they'll buy the land, the rail park from us, because I don't think they would want us to be the operator or their landlord. So they are talking to the Transnet and the authorities. We're not first-hand involved with that, but the feedback that we're getting is, We need to see. There's lots of risk before we commit.
You also pointed out to me, as you said earlier, that train at Nottingham Road. What were you doing there? Having a look at it and a little video that you filmed.
I stop over at Nottingham every now and then. I don't drive just all the way to Belito when I go down there and whatever. And yesterday morning or Tuesday morning after breakfast, I just had a feeling, just go and drive through that industrial part of Nottingham Road towards Moy River. And, you know, Nottingham Road, the railway line goes through the town. If you come from the one side to where the spa and whatever, the railway line sits there, and there the train was stuck. It just stood still there. And I went to the spa and bought stuff, and I saw it was still stuck. And then I drove along. I couldn't get to the locomotives, close to the locomotives, and I saw they were electric locomotives, and there wasn't load shedding in Nottingham Road. and it was just stuck there. And I took that video, drove around, did some things, had some coffee, and an hour later it was still just standing there. I read from newspaper articles that it takes them now 36 hours to bring a train from Durban to Joburg, where it used to be 18 hours. And it's that kind of stuff. And to me, it's now time for Porsche Derby and Transnet to break up Transnet for the sake of the South African economy. It's too difficult for an SOE and people that don't have skin in the game to run it. It needs to be run by a consortium of transport guys or mineral exporters or importers or logistics companies. That it's not working, and it's getting worse and worse, even though all the good announcement, the talk is this way and the action is that way.
So public-private partnerships, in your opinion, are not going to deliver what is required?
I think just, it's a difficult thing to run. Now, if you've got a public-private partnership, the guys are nervous. Who's going to call the shots? And what if we got a dispute? There's an elderly gentleman that's an engineer that specializes on this thing. And he advised to everybody is, take full control.
Or don't get involved.
Don't get involved. You're going to have trouble with Transnet in 5 years' time. They're going to change their mind. They're going to change their policy. The government changed their policy and you sit in the middle. Get full control or don't get involved.
What about the fuel line? I know this is something that's also very close to your heart. You just explain to us, there's what the fuel that comes from Durban to Gauteng.
It goes to Jameson Park there by Heidelberg, and then it goes into various directions to El Road and to Langlaagte and to Waterloo, as far as I know.
And it's a big pipe. With fuel that comes through it.
Fuel comes petrol. Through it and whatever. And it comes through the bottom of my land on the highway park. It follows the N3 alignment.
Is it underground?
It's underground. And one place on my land, there's a control room or whatever, where there's a leak. They come with a truck and they move these concrete slabs and they close the valve so that if there's a breakage in the pipe further down, it's like a stop valve.
Now,
so that's why I'm aware of it, mm-hmm. And there's a servitude right on the boundary of my land to the N3. But when I drove up from Nottingham Road one day in August 2020, just before the Tugela Engine Plaza, I just saw this fountain of liquid coming out the ground, 9 o'clock in the morning. And I got such a fright, and I said, this must be the petrol pipe gushing out stuff. This petrol pipe is supposed to shut down when there's a leak. This is 9 o'clock in the morning. Surely they break into this thing at night. And this thing...
Who breaks into it?
Breaks into it. I don't know who breaks into it.
But they're crooks. In other words, they're stealing petrol.
Yeah, stealing petrol.
From the line. But
from the line. I don't know how. And the reason why I came back, one of the properties next to the port of Gauteng, there was a raid the night before. And people was arrested for stealing fuel. There was 4 tankers parked with crude oil. That one. So I went to my security personnel, phoned me and said there's a raid, and I thought, let me get back there or whatever. And when they raided it, one of these tankers fell over. So these guys stole the crude oil somewhere, and it was in 4 34,000 liter tankers, and they parked it on one of the properties next to Port of Gauteng. And as the forces that be, it was quite an operation with helicopters and whatever, the one fell over and it leaked. When I got there, there was Dritz was the company that did the spillage control. They were on site, 25 skips where they took the contaminated soil and stuff like that. And when I drove back where that fuel spewed out, there was the same type of plastic orange fence around and it said Dritz. So I knew this was a fuel spillage. A few months later when I came back, on the right-hand side, if you drive towards Joburg, just about 20 k's before the Bergville off-ramp, there was a major spillage, massive area cordoned off with this orange sort of tape, and this had Spiltek on it, I think, not Dritz. That site is still standing there, Alec.
The same as it was.
Same site. They've taken the soil, put it in heaps, and then they put plastic over it. Now the sun have burned the plastic to pieces. The rain has come inside the plastic. raining the petrol or whatever, the diesel, it seems like it was diesel there because the soil is black, and spilling it along the N3. And I've sent you the video. And if you stand there along the N3, you can now see as it rained, this path of deafness, where there's nothing, where it's just the petrol has killed everything or the diesel has killed everything. Along the N3 is just continuing. It's gone into the stormwater drain underneath the N3. It's killing the soil, the plants and whatever on the other side of the N3. This happened on 26th of October 2020. The site is abandoned. There was no security that stopped me filming. There was like a portable toilet. There was like a security out. If there was a security guard, he never came out. The site is abandoned. It's not rehabilitated. The one where I saw the fuel coming out in August 2020, that's not rehabilitated yet. The soil is still there. I drove to Walkerville the other day. I go down from Southgate towards the Lido Hotel in that direction. On the left end of the road, there's the same situation. That's where the pipe comes from Jameson Park to Langlaagte. Heaps of sand in plastic that's burned to pieces. So Transnet doesn't seem to rehabilitate these sites. They just leave it. It's shocking because are they now complying with the environmental conditions? What is the environmental? How do a company like Transnet forget about a site like that? How does it go off the radar that there's no more security, no more personnel, that the notice that says stay out of the site is and so? If you go on Google Earth, I'll send you the pin, you see this black area. You see the contamination, hundreds of meters by hundreds of meters, just left there. And as it rains now, there's a river about half a kilometer from there. It's going to hit that river sooner or later. It just seems that there's no, I don't know, what do you call it?
Because Transnet's too big? Is this why?
I just think it's too big and nobody cares. And then the next problem and the next problem. And then they forget about this thing. And they're so overloaded that nobody goes back and says, was this thing cleared? Was it done? But, you know, they're going to have a problem because there's conditions in the EIA. NEMA makes provision for private prosecution. So if the Green Scorpions not prosecute them, private guys might step in. And who is the responsible person at Transnet that's actually going to be prosecuted, that's going to be in the box with the company? Is it the head of the pipe division or is it the head of Transnet? Is it Porsche? But it seems nobody cares. I, with my own eyes, have seen four of these sites. That can't be the only four in the country. And that big one on the N3, as you drive from Escort towards Ladysmith on the right-hand side, about 20 k's before the Bergville off-ramp, is a shocker. It is absolute. It's dead. It's black dead. There's nothing. And there's tons and tons and tons of soil being stored there, plastic disintegrating.
So it sounds like if this was, say, in a river or if it was in a area that was a built-up area, there would be immediate attention on it.
Yes.
In this case, you've observed it with your eye. Clearly, Transnet is falling down in numerous ways on this. Is your suggestion on how this could be addressed and be avoided in future is to break up Transnet into smaller pieces or
manageable pieces, and people with skin in the game. Not, and I've got nothing against an official, somebody that works for the government, but somebody that's got shares in that business, that's put 20 million, or somebody, there's a big boy that's put 200 million rand in this company, and this happened, his share price is going to go from 200 million to 100 million, that will go raving mad, screaming, shouting, and not just explaining. The problem with officials, they explain what happens. But nobody's share price drops from 100 million to 50 million and feel it, and are raving mad and forcing the issue. There's a reason why certain capitalism work. Capitalism can be bad, but there's a boss in there, an owner that's invested money in there, and his share value drops from 100 million to 50 million because of this, and they have to pay this fine. No explanation is going to be good enough for him. He's going to make sure it works. And that's what I think we need. Somebody that's got skin in the game, investors that put 500 million in this company and 500 million in that company, and that will go raving mad if things like this happen.
I'm Lena from Tilburg, and I have the well-known publisher of nonfiction books in South Africa, Jeremy Berain, who's at Jonathan Ball Publishers, in the studio to discuss his move to London, where he will be launching a new imprint of Icon Books. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, Linda.
Can you just tell us how it all sticks together? Icon Books, News 24, Jonathan Ball Publishers, and you know, what are you launching now?
Right. Okay. So in brief, Jonathan Ball Publishers bought Icon Books just around 2 years ago. In fact, upon lockdown, but it was obviously a purchase that took some time. And the moment it was acquired by Jonathan Ball, we looked at synergies, and it's part of a growth plan for Jonathan Ball. And about 9 months ago, it was decided that we would, well, I was offered the opportunity to go and join the Icon team and launch a Jonathan Ball imprint. Icon has, you know, it was privately owned until we bought it, and has been in existence for something like 20 or 25 years. So it's a well-established, albeit small, London-based publisher.
And are you looking for the stories, because it's all non-fiction, and often a political story, of people here or South Africans, or what are you looking for?
I mean, for those of you who know the Jonathan Ball imprint, you know, I think we're best known for South African politics, current affairs, biography, although, you know, by no means do we limit ourselves to that. In taking the imprint broader to the UK and beyond, I can't simply publish South African stories. There isn't the commercial market, you know, globally for that. So my brief, you know, is really to look for political or current affairs or biographical stories that's beyond South Africa. So it may be English or in fact, broader than that. I think something to understand about the Icon publishers is that 40% of what they publish is exported out of the UK. So 60%, they have 60% domestic sales. And so they've got a good footprint in the US and Europe, Australasia. So, you know, really looking for books that might sell sort of anywhere in the world, as opposed to South African. That said, you know, I think I don't want to let go of, you know, Jonathan Ball's roots in Africa. So I do want to acquire and publish some African stories, as it were, perhaps history, biography, current affairs. So retain something of that.
If we look at the books that you have been publishing, can we just look back on that, the period that you've been in South Africa, because you've been doing this for a long time. The most recent one was Pretoria Boy by Lord Peter Hayne.
I mean, you know, whenever anybody asks me what have we been publishing, my mind goes blank, because there's so many books that come out in every year, you know. So we do sort of, you know, 30 or 40 books a year at Jonathan Ball. So Peter Hayne's story of his life in South Africa and his connection to South Africa is one we published last year in September, A Pretoria Boy, that's right. And in fact, there was an interesting sort of publishing story to that, in that it's the first book where Icon Books acquired rights from us. So, you know, a company that we owned then decided to publish it in the UK. So there were two editions. There was the Icon edition in London, and then the Jonathan Ball edition in South Africa. And so that was that was one book from last year.
So how would they differ? You know, I've noticed just in children's books, reading for my children, that when you publish a book in America, you don't talk about the philosophers, don't you? You talk about the sorcerer. Does it differ? Do the covers differ when you publish in South Africa and when you publish in the UK?
A clear difference between those two editions is that in the UK market, for a book of that nature, you would release it as a hardback. Whereas in South Africa, there isn't much demand for hardback, for obvious pricing reasons. So we launched ours as what we call a trade paperback, which is the large size paperback, which is what most South African publishers do with new releases. It's a trade paperback. So that's one difference. And, you know, so I think any publisher in any market is always has to come up with sort of best practice in terms of those decisions, whether it's pricing or format. But essentially, you know, the information was the same. I mean, it's the same text inside, but I think it's quite an interesting departure when you have two publishers looking at the same text and what requirements they might have. So, you know, for example, in Peter's book, there's quite a long court case that took place in the UK. And for South African readers, that might not be as interesting as it would be for British readers. So, you know, my counterpart in the UK sort of said, no, let's keep all of it in. Let's not cut any of that. So likewise, for legal checks, you know, the law is different in the UK as it is to South Africa. So we had to have two legal reads. So, there are all these kinds of considerations when you collaborate on a book like this.
I've always wondered also, how does it differ? How many copies can you sell in South Africa versus overseas and versus in the UK? Do you sell far more copies of a book of somebody like Lord Hayne than a South African?
I haven't looked at the UK sales. It's interesting, you know, so obviously with my move to the UK, I've been taking an increased interest in what sells in the UK. And what I have found, and, you know, this is it's a very general point, is that many books sell the same quantities here as to the UK.
Yeah.
But obviously your bestsellers in the UK do far better. So, for example, you know, under this sort of COVID time where sales have been quite dampened down, it's quite difficult to sell a book. The sales quantities can be very similar. And that's as small as 1,500 or 2,000 or 2,500 copies here and in the UK. But as I said, if something takes off, you know, it'll be selling 10 or 15,000 copies a week in the UK, whereas here it probably just gets up to 1,000 copies a week. So your bestseller opportunities are that much better. It's just a bigger market.
So is that what you're going to – that's why you have to go and look for the bigger market?
Well, that's always the dream, isn't it? I mean, every publisher needs to try and find a bestseller. And easier said than done. But yes, one is always trying, and the publishing model is, where you have a quiver full of books that you go out each year with, and really, I would argue that profitability depends on getting one or two bestsellers. If you don't have them, it's quite hard to make your budget and be profitable. So yeah, that is the idea. Whether I'll achieve that remains to be seen.
And do people always come to you with books, or would you at the moment think, ooh, there's an interest in Russia, maybe we should publish a book on Putin, or how does it work?
That takes a bit of explaining. I mean, we do a lot of our own commissioning of books, which is exactly that. It's, you know, we spend time thinking, what would be of interest to the market? You know, this last book worked. What about this? Or looking to see who might make a good, you know, a biography or unauthorized biography. So we do a lot of active commissioning in our South African operation. And I hope to bring some of that to the work I do in the UK. A big, very big difference between the UK and South Africa is that the UK has a lot of agents, literary agents. So, you know, in some respects, adding that extra dimension into the sandwich, as it were, the literary agents. I mean, they spend a lot of time working with authors, coming up with concepts. So as an editor or a publisher in the UK, you can simply work with agents and sign up books. But I will have to do some of that. But I also would like to sort of take some of what I've learned in the South African market, which is a far more sort of active commissioning type of publishing. So, for example, you know, your example, war breaks out and, you know, Russia attacks Ukraine. There's a global result out of that. And, you know, what might sell 2 years from now? Because you can't publish a book, you know, tomorrow. You need to find someone, they have to write it, then you have to publish it. So it's trying to kind of find an idea that won't have the world moved on from in 18 months or 2 years' time.
Yeah, like Zelensky, who was sort of like almost nobody. And now, you know, he might have this iconic status that might translate into years ahead or whatever. Are there any English politicians that are obvious targets for you, Boris Johnson?
Well, yeah, I mean, we did discuss Boris Johnson, but I guess it was at a time when, you know, he was taking a bit of a beating and a few weeks ago. And, you know, I think some of my English counterparts were wondering whether he would be around.
Exactly.
But he seems to be weathering the storm. And but no, I mean, at this stage, no. You know, I think I need to get there, and I'm not going to be rushing to publish British politicians, their biographies. My sense is that biographies of British politicians don't sell particularly well. I might be wrong, but I don't think they seem to have the, you know, they don't seem to be adored by the public. So I don't know if that's an area I'm going to leap into.
I think politicians that are adored are a really small bunch of people. In that respect, I think South Africa is a bit luckier. Can I ask you then, is there a favorite book that you had? I mean, the one that often sells, Slobbert, is one of the few that I saw you came out and advertised, and because your father knew Van Zyl Slobbert. Was that one of your favorites?
You know, it's difficult. It's kind of like asking someone who their favorite child is, because as a publisher, you grow attached to many authors and projects and books. So it would be unfair to sort of say, well, you know, this was my favorite book. And I think every book you publish, there's different reasons why you may enjoy working on it. In some, it might be the text, and some, it might be this, you know, the sales, because it sells so well. But I think it's sometimes it's about the relationships that you form with authors over a long period of time. So I've, you know, really enjoyed working with Johnny Steinberg. I've really enjoyed working with Mark Gefisser. I've worked with Justice Malala, Margie Orford. So, you know, these are authors that are in it for the long haul, and I've really enjoyed sort of being something of a midwife to at least some of their books. So I can't say that there's a single book that stands out.
So your first appearance in the UK would be at the London Book Fair. So glad that's back. This, you know, with COVID now, the UK is basically ignoring COVID now.
Yeah. So that's in the second week of April. And that is what I do when I touch down, is attend that. And I have attended many times in the past, but obviously this is in a new guise. So it's just good opportunistic timing, really, that it's on when I get there, so I can touch base with a lot of sort of colleagues in the industry and people in the sort of sales sides of things. I think it will be a slightly different fair in that a lot of the foreign attendees are unlikely to come, it seems. So it'll think it might be a slightly slower affair. Years ago, 2007, I think, South Africa was the country of focus, or 2010 maybe, at the London Book Fair, and the volcano came. And so I think there were only about a sort of a quarter of the usual attendees. And apparently it's some people's favorite book fair ever, because all their meetings got cancelled and they got to sit around and chat and network in a much more sort of thorough way. But yes, I will be there.
Just one last question. So Jonathan Bull publishes, it's continuing in South Africa as it always was?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there's no change to that. And, you know, I have a successor who's been appointed, Annie Ulufia, who's quite brilliant. And so we've been doing a sort of a handover over these sort of January to March. And, the team is sort of fit and flourishing and has a really great publishing program for the rest of this year and beyond. So yeah, absolutely, there's no change there at all.
State capture is not possible without this the proceeds of crime flowing through the bank accounts, often destined for bank accounts and companies outside of our borders. Now, take us to Ian Stinton. Who is he? He did testify before the state capture inquiry. In relation to what exactly?
All right. So I just want to pick up on one point that you said, which is important, is that the threshold for reporting is very, very low. If the banks even so much as suspect or should reasonably suspect that that the proceeds of illicit funds are coming into their accounts, they have a duty to report. So that threshold is very, very, very low. Now picking up on Ian Sinton. Ian Sinton was Standard Bank's legal counsel. I don't think he's in that position anymore.
No, he's retired. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So he was called to the Zondo Commission to give evidence. Unfortunately, there was very little by way of explanation in terms of the processes that Standard Bank actually undertook in canvassing and looking for red flags in these transactions, because it's quite obvious that, you know, they in certain circumstances, these accounts that were used to launder money were open for 3 years, 4 years, 5 years without any interference from Standard Bank or any of the regulatory authorities. Now, we would have hoped at the commission to see some evidence or to hear an explanation as to why Standard Bank did not pick up on those red flags, but that evidence was not forthcoming.
Mm. So I was listening to Mr. Sinton's evidence this morning, and he came across very comprehensively in terms of the processes and procedures that financial institutions like Standard Bank are supposed to undertake. And he speaks of a constant monitoring of media reports by an internal team and using Thomson Reuters to look at any adverse media reports that are coming out about their clients. And he says there is a team that is dedicated to looking at suspicious transactions with regard using these particular algorithms. He didn't expand on what algorithms these are. But it seems all of that didn't really work, did it?
Well, either it didn't work or it did work, and the implication of that is that Standard Bank would have turned a blind eye to money laundering. I mean, I'd like to just look at a specific example because I think that'll be helpful. Let's just look at the Regiment's McKinsey situation, because Standard Bank was involved there. Now, we all know that what happened is between 2012 and 2015.
And this is at Transnet.
This is at Transnet, yeah. Yes, thanks for that. Between 2012 and 2015, McKinsey was awarded numerous, I think it was 8 contracts by Transnet that totaled in value at about $2.2 billion. McKinsey then partnered with Regiments as their empowerment partner and paid to Regiments 30% of that $2.2 billion. From there, 55% of that 30% was laundered out of Regiment's accounts to a variety of other accounts. Primarily, I think if I recall correctly, most of those funds went to an entity called Homex, which was a shelf company. And from there, the majority of funds went into an entity called Bapu Trading, also a shell company. And from there, the money went cold, disappears, as happens with money laundering. Now, we know that the money started flowing into the Homex account in about 2014. And we also know that Regiments, Homex, and Bapu Trading all had accounts with Standard Bank. So in 2014, these massive deposits of between 1 to 20 million start going into the Homex account. And that then continues unabated for about 3 years. And it's not, well, we don't know if it was picked up by Standard Bank, but certainly Standard Bank didn't action it. The Financial Intelligence Center didn't action it. The Reserve Bank didn't action it. So this money was being freely laundered from 2014 onwards. We only see Standard Bank pick up on this in 2017, when there are a whole lot of adverse media reports that start coming out in the press in about 2017 around Regiments. And at that point, Standard Bank saw fit to call Regiments into account, and as I understand, after that, reported the matter and I think closed the accounts. Now, the question is, if they have all these wonderful algorithms and they have this team that's dedicated and constantly monitoring as it's supposed to do under legislation, and if they all have this fantastic understanding of the legislation that governs them. What were they doing between 2014 and 2017? I don't buy the explanation that this was a mere oversight. But unfortunately, we don't have the answers. You know, those questions weren't asked at the Zondo Commission, and we didn't receive any clarity. But I also just want to say, Mike, that something that I find repulsive, actually, is the fact that Standard Bank, on their own version, waited until there were negative media reports. In other words, the trigger for Standard Bank was when it was going to incur reputational risk. That suddenly was worthy of interrogation. Mm. But what of all the red flags that they must have picked up on in those other 3 to 4 years?
You've been listening to the Power Hour, brought to you by the team at BizNews.